Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Missing. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today, Tim. I love it when we have these special episodes where we can present to the audience a bit of a gift that we received. This is something that came to us through the nonprofit that we are on the board of, that most people are aware of, Private Investigations for the Missing. This is not a typical investigation for the missing that our famed detective, Lou Berry, worked on. But it was presented to us. And when that happened, I don't know about you, Tim, but I felt like this was a gift. We got to present something special to the audience, and we got something special too.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing story. And Private Investigations for the Missing is the nonprofit that you mentioned, Lance, that we're on the board of. Lou Berry is also on the board of it, and he's going to join us in this first segment. What Private Investigations for the Missing does is investigate missing persons cases when families don't have the means to do so themselves. And typically it's cold cases. But what PIs for the Missing doesn't do is investigate missing animals. And this episode is actually about a missing dog named Da Vinci, who Lou Berry helped locate. But the tie-in here is that the owner of Da Vinci, Da Vinci's friend, Christina, was missing and trafficked at one point in the past. And so Christina joins us in this conversation as well in the second segment.
I love how you said her friend. And I just think it's a remarkable set of circumstances when someone in her position has this pet friend, and this is a living being that helped her get through the most difficult time in her life to help her recover. And that friend goes missing. And I just love the set of circumstances when she reached out to Private Investigations for the Missing. And I'm not going to give the details of the email because I believe Lou says what exactly it was in that email, the context of it that really kind of tugged at Lou's heartstrings. And as you and I know, Tim, for Lou to have heartstrings and for somebody to actually be able to tug them is pretty impressive.
Well, he's a dog guy. So, and you know, in several of our interviews with Lou, you can hear his dogs.
And Christina becomes the first official person on this show to have an interview with us from the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, I thought that was very fitting, actually, that that she did this conversation from this this cafe right next to the Statue of Liberty.
Well, you think about it in a metaphorical sense. You have somebody who came out of captivity right there at the base of Lady Liberty, the symbol of freedom. So I don't know if she intended this to be highly symbolic, but that's how I'm going to take it now. And again, this is the gift that I was talking about. And speaking of dogs and cats and pets, Tim, as you know, there's really severe weather patterns happening all throughout the country. Significant cold weather happening in areas that don't typically experience significant cold. So we just wanted to put it out there. If you have a pet, please be mindful of your pet's comfort and safety in these situations, in these conditions. Make sure they're properly equipped when taking them outside and making sure they're comfortable. And, you know, don't walk your dog through areas that have all of that rock salt if they're trying to melt the ice. I mean, that just rips up the dog's paws. So just be mindful. Just wanted to give a quick PSA there.
All right, everyone. Thanks a lot for listening. We're going to play the first segment with Lou Barry now. But first, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Lou Barry of PIs for the Missing. Lou Barry, welcome back to the podcast. How are you today?
Great, thanks. Always a pleasure. How's everything with you?
Yeah, things are going really, really well over here. We're coming off of this conversation that you had directed us toward. It's a private investigations for the missing related case, a related story, but not typical to what private investigations for the missing does on a regular basis. But before we get to that, I know hundreds of thousands of people already know who you are, but can you just give us a brief rundown of you and what you've done and your position with the organization?
Well, I spent about 35 years in law enforcement, 24 as chief, and then retired, did some private investigating, and got involved with Mr. Maitland on his daughter's case, Brianna. And then subsequently through that, got involved in the nonprofit Private Investigations for the Missing. Through them, my role primarily is to screen cases when they come in, a case request. I talk to the family, I talk to law enforcement, and then determine, number one, if it fits our criteria, and if so, make a recommendation to the board of directors. And if they decide that it's a case that we, you know, can take on, then I find a competent private investigator, and they basically turn it over to them and they run with it.
And what is the mission of Private Investigations for the Missing?
It was started by Bruce through a conversation he had with Greg Overacker, who's put in a number of hours on Brianna's case, obviously himself, since the mid-2000s, I think, early 2000s. Bruce recognized the need for private investigators to assist families, particularly in cold cases, because law enforcement gets kind of overwhelmed at times. They don't have the resources on many occasions to be able to devote to cases as they get historic in nature. And they have a tendency to sit on a shelf and gather dust. And as time goes by, less and less is done on a case actively. So Bruce recognized the value of private investigators that could concentrate and work with and for the family. So that's why he started the organization. And that's basically what we do. We provide families of missing persons, specifically cold case missing persons, because many, many of the requests that we get in are very fresh within days, weeks, months. And we just can't handle the volume. We've had over I think 175 case requests since January 1st. Obviously, we rely on donations, and we just don't have the resources to devote a private investigator to all those cases.
This is probably a great time to cut in and mention that PIs for the Missing does run on your donations. If you've got any room in your budget, we know PIs for the Missing really appreciates your donation. Check out investigationsforthemissing.org. Okay, so tell us about what happened with this case when Christina Blunt emailed you. She mentioned her email. Would you be able to discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, she contacted us and was looking for a private investigator, and she told me a little bit about her background. I'm not sure how much she shared with you about that. She, you know, said that she was suffering from PTSD as a result of, you know, what she had gone through as a victim. And she had an emotional support animal, specifically a dog named Da Vinci, who was a schnauzer. She explained that last April she had gone somewhere or something and left it with a so-called friend. And when she got back and went to get the dog wasn't there. And the friend said that she'd give her a couple of stories that she'd given it away, or that it was in Florida, it was in a shelter. So I explained to her that, you know, we don't do dogs, you know, we do missing persons. Yet I felt bad for her, because I realized just in talking to her how much this dog meant to her and how much of a asset it was to person in her type of situation. So I told her I'd try and help her as best I could anyways. And subsequently located the woman that she had left the dog with, who had moved, and not told her where she had moved to. So she couldn't find her. She had been to animal control, and they said, hey, there's nothing we can do. We don't know where the woman is. We don't know where the dog is. We can't help you. So I located the woman anyways and supplied her with that information. And she subsequently supplied that information to animal control, who went out and found the dog. I guess was at a shelter right down the street from where the person lived. So I think on Thanksgiving Day, she was reunited with Da Vinci, and they returned to New York. So it was pretty, you know, it was a good feeling to be able to help this girl out, even though, again, it's not a person, it was a dog, but still, you know, we're in the business of helping people, and that's what we did, I guess.
What was it about her initial request that stood out in a way where you felt like this is something that you needed to be a part of and help her out with?
Something she said really kind of hit home with what we're doing now. And that's one of the things she said is, I wish this organization had been around back when I was a victim, because she said no one looked for me. I felt bad that we weren't around and there wasn't an organization back then that could look for her. I don't, maybe that was part of it. I just have a soft spot for victims and dogs. So
how was Christina reunited with Da Vinci?
As far as I know, she took the bus down. She lived somewhere in New York, I assume New York City, although I don't know that for a fact. And this was down in Maryland. So as far as I believe, she took the bus down, because I know she said on Thanksgiving Day, she and Da Vinci returned on the bus to New York. So, but my guess is that that's what happened. Once they located the dog, I did follow up with her afterwards. After I had given her the information and she told me the dog had been located, I followed up maybe a couple of days after Thanksgiving to see how she made out. And that's when she told me that they had been reunited and spent Thanksgiving Day on the bus back to New York.
It's a really cool story that ended in a really positive way. Having the capability to look into something like that and providing the information to someone to make it all happen is really remarkable. And I'm wondering if you would be open to doing this more often with pets.
No.
No.
Like I said, we had 175 cases come in since January. So that really, really can get time consuming. Is making phone calls, waiting for phone calls to come back. You know, sometimes it can take 2 weeks just to get contact established and get things rolling. So although I'd love to be able to help people with it, I really can't commit the nonprofit, obviously, to doing that. That's just not the focus of it. That's all. Not to say that if a similar situation ever arose that I'd turn them down, but I wouldn't want to give anyone false hope or information out there, and certainly wouldn't want to commit the nonprofit into expanding our role. She's very lucky. From what I know of trafficking victims, she's very lucky to get out of that situation. Another thing that I think is notable in her case, she's African-American. Unfortunately, I hate to say this, but even fewer resources are put, in my experience, towards people of color, indigenous people. It's too bad, but they don't have the support structure many times. And I know nothing of her background whatsoever, but it sounded like she didn't really have family that was supportive, or I don't know, or at least there was no one, according to her, no one was looking for her, which is kind of sad. And that still goes on. I think people get trafficked and go missing and no one looks for them. In fact, our first quote find from the nonprofit was a young African-American male runaway, and we found him and no one had been looking for him. He had run away at 16 and put in a database, and that was the end of that. And we did locate him safe and sound, and in Maryland, actually. That's just another aspect of things that where I hope the nonprofit can help out. And I think that's Bruce's intent also. That's one of the reasons he started it. You know, many times these cases that get a lot of attention are spurred by the media. In the media, as pointed out by the Gabby Petito case, you know, the pretty girl from the suburbs, it's gone missing. That's the attention grabber for the media, and that's the cases that get attention. It's too bad. I mean, not that they shouldn't, but everybody, they all should. You know, ironically, the dog being an emotional support animal is helping her as a trafficking victim. And in a sense, the dog got trafficked and she took the efforts to find the dog and, you know, rescue the dog, so to speak.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. And now here is Christina speaking about how she was missing and trafficked in the past.
We have been looking forward to this conversation with you because it's a little bit different than the usual conversations that we have. It's a great, refreshing change of pace, but this has become even better because we have never had a guest come on who is about to record with us, and then they say, I had to go to the Statue of Liberty to do so.
Yeah, pretty much.
Why are you at the Statue of Liberty?
I don't know. I went to a Christmas party, so I was off of class this morning, and I don't know. I just was around the Statue of Liberty. I was going to get on the ferry to Staten Island, and then I saw the Statue of Liberty, and I was like, well, payday pass. I don't see why not. I have the time, and it's no better day than today. And I'm celebrating because I'm actually releasing music soon at the end of the year, Christmas Eve. So it's kind of a celebratory type of thing.
Oh, very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What kind of music?
I do poetic hip hop.
Nice.
I actually originally was going to come out under the artist name Missing Black Girl because I was, you know, a missing teen. But I felt like the name was a little too triggering and all the subject matter. I was actually trafficked when I was missing. So it was kind of triggering and a little depressing. So now I'm coming out as an artist named Butta. And it feels a lot lighter. It's more based on love and healing after the trauma and things like that than just based in the trauma.
This has already been one of my favorite interviews so far this year.
Thank you.
That's amazing. How did you decide that was the style of music that you wanted to pursue?
Well, so I've been a poet since I was about 12, 13 years old. I'd say about 12. I also did music. I played three instruments, piano, trumpet, and French horn. Was in the church choir. So I've always loved music and I've always loved poetry. And I secretly liked hip hop when I was a kid. So I say secretly because I had two older brothers. And whenever we got the radio to be able to change from Oldies 100 and gospel music, you know, we'd be fighting over the radio. And I'd be like, I want to listen to pop. But, you know, so it was just a natural evolution of, I guess, where my music would have gone. So still keeping with poetry, but not quite like spoken word. So more the beat of hip hop.
Wow, very cool. And where can we listen to that when it's available?
It will be on all platforms, okay. You know, starting Christmas Eve. And I'll make sure to keep you all updated.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
I saw a French horn once.
Uh-huh.
It scared the crap out of me. I don't know how you do it. Good for you.
It's such an awesome instrument, honestly. The tones are so mellow and it just, you feel like an instrument yourself when you play it, honestly. Because you have to do the most. Like, you have to play with the opposite hand of the trumpet, but then you use the hand that you were playing with the trumpet and you kind of use it to kind of round out and mellow out those tones. So I actually look forward to playing again one day. I actually stopped playing instruments when I left home. So bittersweet.
Would you want to talk about that at all when you were missing and trafficked?
Yeah. So I was 17 and an at-risk youth and stuff like that had kind of already gone through a lot of traumatic events and things like that. And I had a medical emergency, as I would say. I was a little manic and ended up going missing. And within 2 days, I was being trafficked in another state. So, yeah, like literally the worst case scenario happened. So now that that's over, I'm ready to live. Like, you know, there's only one way to go, you know, from there. So luckily I was out of that life within 2 years, by the age of 18, by I was 18 or 19. And just kind of been rebuilding since. It's been a little rough, you know, being, you know, just having a title, missing person, like, it's not as, I mean, it doesn't sound fun, but it's a hard life because you go through the years of being missing, but going through some of the things I went through, it seemed like everybody kind of turned into, in my point of view, an enemy, not really an enemy, but like, oh, the police don't care about me. Well, my family it doesn't feel like they look for me. You know, the world just kind of becomes an opposing force, and even trying to make it back into being a part of the world is difficult because there's a lot to get through. Just even getting your ID and your birth certificate and having to get your Social Security card, those three things right there is hard enough. But then to, do I get a GED? How do I get a job? Like, how does the world even work when you're kind of living as a product of the black market? Like, it gets weird.
I think it is incredibly important to have this discussion with you because we talk about a lot of missing individuals that come from at-risk environments, whether it's their community or whether it's their family or a number of circumstances. But no one really talks about the trafficking thing in a serious way. It's it's like we talk about a missing individual and the idea or the one hypothesis is that, oh, maybe they were trafficked. And that's typically where the conversation ends. We try to elaborate on it, but I don't know why. Maybe it has something to do with how you said, you know, you were a product of the black market. No one wants to think about that. No one wants to think about a 16, 17-year-old young woman going into this black market because that's about as like dark as it gets. So I think it's important to see someone like yourself come out of it. You know, you're a musician. You have a great story, a great survivor story.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. But I'm wondering, we don't really get an opportunity to ask this question. When you were taken, when you were missing, was it immediately clear to you that this was a trafficking situation, or was that like a gradual thing that happened?
I mean, I would say a little bit of both. I mean, I knew within the first day, like, what it was. Like, when you're literally watching money exchange hands for you, like, it's kind of like a deep moment. But at the same time, like, it was scary. And honestly, like, I just now in life started getting support of different organizations that have been helping me finally get through. That's why I'm at the Statue of Liberty today, you know, because I feel like I finally reached that point of liberty. But I remember the first organization that ever approached me was when I was on the track in D.C. And this was within 24 hours of me being missing. And I was missing from like 15 minutes away in D.C. Maryland. All they offered me was a list of bad tricks and some condoms. And I was like, oh, this is my welcome party to hell. That's what this is. Okay, so this is really happening. So yeah, it was pretty apparent, like, in the beginning. But obviously, when I first went missing, like, I didn't know what was going to happen. And the crazy thing about it, I actually just wrote a song mentioning this. But when I left home, like, I was super manic. And I only brought with me a backpack full of poetry. I didn't bring food. I didn't bring clothes. Like, I didn't bring money. Like, none of the stuff that, like, a reasonable person would pack to take on a deserted island that I bring. I just brought, like, pages and pages and books of poetry that I had written over, what, 3 or 4 years that I planned to publish. And it's telling because now it comes full circle and I'm entering the world of hip hop, which is based in poetry. So I'm like, I guess I saved the right thing, you know? It didn't get far. The poetry didn't make it far, but I guess it got further than I could have expected, because some of the words that I speak in some of my music even comes from the time while I was trafficked, which I actually had a 15-year writer's block after I went missing. So it speaks volumes that some of those words still broke through.
Wow, amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. How did you get out of the situation?
I had another manic episode. I know it sounds crazy, but you know, like the way I went in was the way I came out. And I mean, I don't know what y'all's beliefs are, right? So I was really manic, and I actually have this song called Angels, and I swore I saw angels. I just remember like really like praying really, really hard to get out of my current situation. I was like, I'm going to die like this. And I don't know. I felt like I was rescued by angels. I don't know. I can't explain it. But I told a gorilla pimp to his face I was leaving, and he didn't put a hand on me. It was shocking because, you know, people always ask the ignorant question of, oh, well, when you're trafficked and you're like off on your own, why don't you just leave? Why don't, like, nobody's holding a gun to your head. There is so much mental bondage that happens when you're in slavery. And I didn't realize until after I got out how much bondage I was in. Like, I was literally walking a beach for like 80 blocks until I kind of just like figured it out. Eventually jumped on a bus and went to Atlanta and started a new life. I mean, it didn't go that smoothly, but, you know, I was free. But it was a lot of, you know, you have Stockholm syndrome, you have the whole thing I was saying about, oh, nobody on the planet cares about me for real. Love, you know, my heart was butchered before I even had the chance to fall in love. The stereotypes, the way I judge myself, you know, me feeling like I was a sinner. Is anybody ever gonna love me? Like, how do I do life? I'm so lost. Like, and then the crazy thing is, like, back in, this was, would have been around 2008 when I got out of the life. So there weren't, even though there may have been some organizations popping up or some may have been available, we didn't have smartphones like we do today. We didn't have resources readily at our fingertips. So I was literally winging it. Like, I didn't have utilized any resources to get out of what I was in. I don't know, somehow made it. And it was a longer road for me having had to do that. And that's kind of why I want to utilize my gifts to make it an easier road for somebody else, honestly. Because I'm 35 now, and I got out when I was, like I said, 18, 19. And I'm just now getting to a point in my life where I'm feeling free.
Yeah, it took some time.
It took some time. It's still a work in progress, but I'm on to the good part.
Yeah, good, good. And how do you even begin to start?
I know, right? It was a lot of picking up the pieces. And even since then, like, you know, obviously we connected after I had, you know, I deal with PTSD as well. And I wasn't even diagnosed with PTSD until I was about 30 years old. So I didn't know how to manage it. You know, you think of PTSD and you think of war vets, but, you know, and I'm getting a little emotional now, but I went through a lot, like literally, you know, and this was 2006 to 2008 when I was trafficked. So it's not like I was on the internet. I wasn't just sitting around a house being shopped on the internet. I was literally on a track, like jumping in and out of cars, not knowing, you know, is this going to be the last car I get into? I've looked into the eyes of serial killers, and I don't know that for a fact, but I literally been in a car with somebody who like just stopped speaking, blanked out, parked the car by some warehouses and went to his trunk and popped it. And I'm taking off running in 5-inch heels. Like, you know, like I've lived through some stuff as a teenager. I was like forced to grow up. And I mean, like you said, where do you start? Like, I don't know. I believe in God, and I believe in my gifts that I've been given, which was, one of them was poetry. So even though I wasn't writing at the time, like I kind of had to find other ways to express myself artistically. And that kind of got me through. I got comfortable with being nomadic. So I moved all over the East Coast. Like, nowhere felt like home. I went for a long time without having friends because I didn't know how to be a friend. Like, it was weird. Even tried dating once. That didn't work out. Ended up in a DV situation. But, like, I mean, so I don't know. I just finally am being patient with myself and not trying to, like, fix every piece of me, because a lot was broken. A lot happened. And I don't think most people can really fathom what it would have been like to not even just be trafficked, but being a missing person and being a teenager and being an African American. It's crazy to me. And this is for all missing people, right? It blows my mind that I was arrested repetitively as a teenager, charged as an adult for prostitution. They ran my fingerprints and I was on the missing and exploited persons list. I had an active APB out of me at one point. Why is it that you have a system that if you run your fingerprints, they could find warrants, they could find out if you lied about your name, but they don't have anything that coincides with the missing exploited persons list, with active APBs, with missing teens? And honestly, like, when I make it big, because I'm going to claim it, you know, and I have the money to do so. We have so much technology now. We're on to doing AI things. Like, it really just takes getting the right people together and finding a way so that people aren't falling through the holes. Because you have, if you think about the story of, who's the young lady? She was recently released from prison after doing, what, 13, 15 years? Centoya Brown. Centonia. I hope I'm saying her name right. But if you think about a young lady like her, like, she had probably been arrested before for prostitution. And she was a teenager at the time. Like, she could have gotten back all those years of her life that she missed if people had, like, even with the foster care system, I think all that stuff should be in that programming, honestly. I don't know. I'm a little technologically based, but I'm not that advanced. But one day, I'm putting that energy out there. I hope to, you know, be a part of a team that can make that happen. It'll find a lot of missing kids and missing adults, too, because it's not just kids on the missing and exploited persons list.
That makes no sense whatsoever that they weren't able to connect those dots.
Right. I literally was arrested more times than I could count in a very small amount of time. So across state, even in the same state that I was missing from. And then so I was arrested in Maryland, arrested in D.C. Like, but the crazy part about it, and maybe I'm over talking, but I'm going to say this. So I was arrested in D.C. and I ended up being assaulted by who I believe was a U.S. Marshal, a ranking member of the U.S. Marshal. He took me from a courthouse to his home and sexually assaulted me. And the crazy part about it, he sent two detectives to me to kind of rile me up a little bit before they brought me to him. And they were like, we know who you are. We know your real name. We know your age. We know your record. We know, you know what I'm saying? So they're telling me all this and then utilizing that information to exploit me further. Nobody thought to call my parents. Nobody thought to ask me, like, you know, like when you were thinking back to the 90s where we would see missing people on TV, like, you just think, like, of these, like, you know, when they say call the cavalry. The cavalry comes, they found the girls, you know, and everything's good. They're rescued. In real life, it doesn't work like that. Nobody cares. Like, matter of fact, you're even more vulnerable because you're missing and nobody cares. It sucks, but it feels like the truth, honestly.
This was an active member of the U.S. Marshal?
I believe so. And It took me a very, very long time to follow up. I actually found out if I had pressed charges within 6 months of it happening, I probably could have sued the whole District of Columbia. But D.C. being one of the most corrupt states, you know, like when it comes to the police force, and then knowing like, okay, there's two detectives involved. There's a U.S. Marshal who might be ranking. I don't know if he was a sergeant or what. I don't remember, but he had an office. And I believe the head of the prostitution unit was involved. So why would I go press charges? And I was still being trafficked. You know what I'm saying? Like somebody with enough pull to say, if you ever get arrested in the state, tell them you're my niece. And gives me his business card. Like he wasn't afraid of anything. But obviously I couldn't keep the business card because I'm still being trafficked. If my pimp found law enforcement business card on me, I'm in trouble. So, you know, when I got around to reporting it and kind of navigating through my PTSD at the time, it was very rough. I went back to the courthouse and tried to identify the office. Couldn't do it because so many years had passed. And I finally looked at some pictures of some people they thought could have been it. And I couldn't identify anybody. And I just busted out in tears. And I was just like, you know, I don't get any justice. Like, you know, I'm not just going to say, oh, that's the guy, not knowing if that's the guy or not, and just send some random dude to jail. And it was an old guy. So I'm like, I'm not going to send some like 60-year-old man to prison. And I'm not sure, you know, but I don't know. It was a lot to work through. And honestly, it comes full circle because I'm not getting any justice for being trafficked. I finally reported my trafficking years later with so many minimal details, like not knowing anybody's name. I had more than one pimp. And the only pimp that I could actually identify, I found out he died. So I'm like, oh, I'm never going to get justice, you know? But my first album I'm dropping is actually called Poetic Justice. So I'm excited. So it's like my own form of justice. Like, I made my way out of it. I found my own justice. Like, and here we are. Here it is.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. Can you tell us about your dog, Da Vinci?
Okay, so Da Vinci is my first son. He is my ESA, and I'm his ESP, emotional support person. He's a lot like me, a big ball of sunshine, people person. He actually just left the ASPCA. They were temporarily boarding him. And they were like, oh, he has a nickname. We call him Binky. He got all the extra bedding, the staff loves him, like definitely a people person and a dog person. But I was just recently reunited with him, thank goodness, after, like I stated, my last little episode of PTSD, I relocated from Florida to New York, and he was kind of shuffled around a little bit and ended up being taken by a family member. I was blocked on everything and had no idea where he was being told so many different stories about, oh, he went to a shelter, to, oh, he went to a new family, to nobody cares to tell you.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what you did when he went missing?
So first I panicked. Well, I know. Actually, I mean, I did panic a little bit, but I had to take a little bit to get through the shock that it was actually happening by somebody who was not just a family member, but somebody I considered as a friend. Like, we were friends from the cradle, you know, and I was shocked. You know, this person who said they would keep my dog for me until I was able to get on my feet and, you know, so that I wouldn't have to lose him, ended up being the person standing in the way of me getting him back. But luckily, like I said earlier about being involved now with organizations that are helping me, who are more connected to like HT type stuff. I'm working with this, an attorney in DC, and she was actually very, very instrumental in keeping me calm and doing things the legal way and making suggestions and things like that. And she's actually keeps telling me, like, you did it all, girl. Like, you literally, you know, kept finding new ways to do things, you know, because I'm thinking I got to take her to court. You know, I tried to call the police, but they're like, you know, I couldn't even file in person because, you know, it was a civil claims type of situation. But the problem was I didn't know where my cousin lived. So I was like, how would I even serve her? How can I even, you know, find anything? So I honestly just started scouring the internet for resources. And then I came up with the bright idea, like, I think I need a PI. I got to find out where this, you know, after using Truth Finder and all the other places to find somebody's address, I'm like, I don't think I'm updating the system fast enough. I don't know how to use this stuff that tomorrow I'm going to be charged like $50 for all this stuff anyway. So, you know, I just kind of started like from my knowledge of the fact that there are organizations out here that help people who do certain, there's some organizations that will do things pro bono for certain people. Like that was my only hope because I don't have an income right now, not extended income, I should say, you know, and I think that was kind of the plate that gotcha moment. Like, oh, I feel like I could just steal her dog because she doesn't have the resources to get him back. She doesn't have, you know, the money to even get down here and get him. But, you know, I was able to locate him and then followed up by calling animal control. And honestly, I had help locating him. So, and I appreciate like every single person who was a part of that, honestly, because Da Vinci's my light. Like, honestly, he makes life better. I see why dogs are prescribed to people who have PTSD, because there's days where you feel like you can't get out of the bed or you're triggered by something, or just having another life to take care of, honestly, it makes a big deal. So that's what, you know, when reaching out, you know, I mentioned that, like, he's my family. Like, I have a family. I have a mother who loves me very much, but I've been on my own since I was 17, and I can't imagine life without him. Like, honestly, he's like a part of my resurrection, where I finally feel like I'm in a place where I could take care of another being and hopefully one day have kids, you know? So I wasn't about to lose him. I'll just say that. But yeah, he was recovered, and, you know, thank goodness for animal control, because, you know, he has anxiety. I also, at that point, didn't have a sign of life for my dog. So I'm having nightmares thinking about, oh, my God, what if he got hit by a car? And, you know, I'm just being lied to so nobody hurts my feelings. And, you know, those are all very real realities. And somebody with anxiety and PTSD, like, that's a super real reality. That you think of, like, I'm a very optimistic person, but having, you know, trauma, I have to be realistic. I have to have a piece of pessimism in me in order for things to make sense. And that goes with, like, I know we were talking about before how, like, why a lot of people don't speak up about certain things. I've had to deal with being stereotyped for leaving home at 17. So, which is weird to me, because I've had people tell me to my face that they were mad at me for leaving, when it's like, oh yeah, I just woke up one morning and said, I'm just going to drop out of high school, grab all my poetry, and just go out in the world and just let it take me. Yeah, that sounds really exciting. But you'd be surprised about, like, how many people hold that against you or feel like you can't finish things or whatever. And then to top it off, to put more fuel to fire, having had left because of mental health reasons, that's a whole nother stereotype that's added on top of all of that, you know. And then people try to get into quote unquote helping you or whatever they want to call it, when it's like, nobody was there when I was picking up the pieces of my life. Not really. Like, I lived a lot of years. It was at least 5 years of my life where I had no family. I had no friends. I had no nobody. It was just me and God. Like, and I barely even recognized God at the time, you know? So it was just me bopping through life. So for people to then think that, oh, you know what? She can't handle having a dog. She must be in a horrible situation or this or that. Let me fix the situation for her or whatever, you know, it's kind of like effed up. And unfortunately, I'll probably deal with stereotypes the rest of my life.
I just wanted to follow up on, again, that thought about why no one talks about this. And you keep like delivering these pieces of information that reinforce the reason why no people don't talk about it. And I just realized like people are judging young women in your situation just solely based on their own selfish qualities. I mean, they were putting it on you. Why, you know, why did you leave? Well, it's not about how you feel when I left. It's about what happened to you, right? Does that make any sense? Like a lot of the stuff that they judge from comes from a point of view of, look what you did to me when you left. You know, look what you did to my life, and I had to deal with that. And they're not listening to, you know, you didn't just leave. You didn't just say like, that sounds like a good idea, like you said. So I feel like a lot of it is like, no one really wants to look in the mirror and be like, I have issues here. It's not just this person.
Everybody on this planet has been through something that another person can't possibly understand or fathom, or something that we're ashamed of, or whatever, something we regret. Like every single one of us who is a human being, it doesn't matter if you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth or born in a hut, we've all had moments where life has just been life, and we're just sitting there as the main character wondering, how did I get here? I don't know if this is good. But yeah, it sucked. And it was like, even in Da Vinci being taken from me, it hurt. It hurt a lot because it was hard to realize that it's still family members that think of me like that. But at the same time, I had to remember, while I was gone and didn't have communication for however many years, they were left to draw up their own stories about me, had their own imaginings about where I was, what I was doing. I'm sure my own father told me, you know, he was surprised that I hadn't had a crack baby by the time I had called him, which was about 2 years later I contacted him. And I was hurt. I still have no kids. You know what I'm saying? And I've never done crack. So, but people, like, they draw up their own stuff and it carries over. So once I came back, you know, I see family from time to time, but nobody's living with me. They're not with me every day. And so they don't really know, like, who I am, what I do, how I navigate life. And they still kind of come at me with some of those thought processes that they build about me, the negative things that were said about me. Oh, she was just some bad kid that ran off, probably out doing this, that, and the third. Who knows? Like, it sucks. Like, even when I went missing, like, it wasn't looked at like, this is a person who's having a medical emergency and needs help. I was looked at like I was a bad kid who was just out making bad decisions. Look, she used to get in trouble at school all the time. She goes to alternative school because she got kicked out of her last school. Mind you, I got kicked out of my last school following the year that I was had an attempt to rape on me when I was 14. You know, so it's like, people don't really look at the whole story. They just look at the bad parts and be like, you deserve that or whatever. I don't know. Because a lot of people, those people that think that way, they treat me like I just decided to throw away my life. Like, I'm just out, you know. And this is not going on people with drug addiction at all, because they have their own struggles and things like that. And who am I to say how they got there? But it's looked at like I decided to throw my life away. Or I'm still out doing badly. Yeah, I have trouble keeping a job and different things, but I suffer from PTSD. I suffer from feeling like I need to catch up on life. Like, I'm releasing music at 35 years old, a little late to the game, like, but still, like, I don't know. I feel like once I transition into this new chapter of my life that I'm very confident about, it's going to be some people that are almost upset, like, And it's sad because I don't think they mean to feel that way, but they've gotten so comfortable with feeling like they're bigger than you and you're down here that when you start rising up, they're like, oh, man, I ain't never see that coming. Like, so I hope to shock the world, honestly.
Yeah, and I think it does like require people to take a look at themselves when they see someone in your position, even, though you're saying, you know, you're late to the game, you're still entering the game, and it doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you have the talent and the drive and the ambition to do so, then, and you do it. I think a lot of people look at that and they're like, oh man, I was too comfortable. I had all these, I had all these aspirations too, and I didn't do anything because why? I don't have a reason. So I think it's tough. I think it's a tough thing.
Yeah. And then to do it as a high school dropout is kind of cool. But you know what? Every little piece of your journey kind of like shows you that the next piece is possible. Cause I got my GED in 2010. And at first I was very against getting my GED because one of my brothers told me that, you know, my dad was very upset that I left. You know, it was messy. Long story short, he was like, you know, dad's not going to accept you back in the family unless you get your GED. And my stance was like, well, if it's a piece of paper that's keeping us apart and keeping y'all from accepting me as like a family member and a human being, I'm not getting my GED. I was very rebellious. And it was funny. I was in Atlanta and I went to this city hall meeting, real random, because right after I got out of the life, like, I knew I wanted to do something. Like, I wanted to start an organization that was helpful to not only missing people who have been trafficked, but also to people who were put in gangs at young ages, like, you know, like kids that were kind of young boys that were kind of born into the gang culture and never really had a chance at having a better life and were already in the system by a young age. Like, I cared about all that. And I went to this town hall meeting and I'm sitting there like, yeah, and I want to do this and I want to do that. But I don't know the first thing about this or that. I don't even have my GED. And some politician, I don't know who it was, but he was somebody important. He came to me and was like, I must have the GED cause, and turns around, gives you $50 to get my GED. I actually did not get it done at that time. I was still like immature and dealing with certain things, but I went back in 2010, got my GED, never even studied for the test. Mind you, this is about a good 4 or 5 years after I dropped out of school, hadn't done any schooling. I scored in the top 10 percentile of the country and in the top 3 percentile in math, no studying. So I'm like, man, if I had studied, I could have aced it. So when people kind of say things to me ignorantly that insult my intelligence, at least I can like have a cheeky smile to myself knowing like, at least I know I'm not done. Because I had to question myself a little bit. We're kind of like, we're put in this world where, you know, there's tests and different things that rate our intelligence. And if you don't complete school, are you as intelligent? But especially like I'm coming into the perfect industry, right? Hip hop is a place where you have people who become millionaires and billionaires who never, like, think about Nas, right? The kid, I don't even think he made it to junior high. And he literally dropped one of the dopest, most classic albums of all time, like of any genre. So very intelligent for his lyrics of all that. It wasn't because, oh, he had great beats. Like, this man is like a genie, like a mythical character when it comes to the way he uses the English language. So I don't know. So I feel good. Like I'm following the right dreams in a place that, like, I honestly feel like hip hop embraces me, you know, and even being in New York, I feel embraced. I feel at home here, like the birthplace of hip hop, because you could be a rebel, you could be a dropout, you could be a misfit, a black sheep, you know, somebody who is stereotyped, somebody who's been through tragedy, who's been a little convict and all that type of stuff, like, and yet somehow there's still a way where I cannot just get by or have enough to go on a cute little vacation or buy some Fendi. Like, I might be able to do something like what we were talking about earlier, like doing something that could change the whole system of how we treat missing children, especially.